12. Trouble. The first week or two we were underway, I was asleep as much as awake, or more, which got Mother worried. She had me go talk to Dr. Jefferson, who asked me whether I felt depressed, and I'm afraid my response was a little loud and emotional. I mean, no, I wasn't depressed. I was just imprisoned and hurtling off to some uncertain future, probably to die before I was legally an adult. And I asked him, "Aren't you depressed?" He smiled and nodded. "Maybe not, yes," and gave me a light hug, the big black bear, which might have made me slightly telepathic. It wasn't so much the abstract danger. I was really upset at not being able to concentrate, falling asleep over my college homework. But what was that, compared to being the only doctor aboard, waiting for someone to need an appendix out, or even a brain tumor? Or just pulling a tooth, or looking up someone's ass with an assoscope? He only had to take care of 32 of us, but anything could happen, and he was responsible for our life or death. He probably had a suitcase full of pills for depression, and said he'd give me some if I needed them, but first, he wanted me to keep a personal record for a week. How many hours asleep and awake. When I lost my temper or felt like crying. After a week, we would talk about it. He said he was no psychologist, but that seemed to work. Maybe because I wanted to impress him or reassure him. After a week, I was sleeping 8 hours, counting the hours lying with my eyes closed listening to music, and pretty much awake the rest of the time. And I was undramatically less sure that space wanted to kill us all, especially me. All of us between 10 and 20 had jobs, which is to say, chores. Mine was easy, cleaning the galley after meals. A lot less mess than the kitchen at home, with nothing actually cooked. Card had to clean the shower, which I suppose enriched his fantasy life. Everybody spent 30 minutes a day learning about Mars. That was mostly boring reinforcement of stuff we already knew, or should have known. I tolerated the half hour until regular classes started, and really just sort of thought about other things while it droned on. Nobody was testing me on Mars facts, but I had exams in history and math and philosophy. Of course, Mars would test me on Mars. I knew that and didn't think about it. School was absorbing, but tiring. Part of it was that every professor was a kind of a star. I suppose every subject, every department, picked its most dramatic teacher for the VR classes. But the net result was almost like being yelled at. "This led to the Hundred Years' War! How long do you think that war lasted?"
"Look where potassium and sodium are on the periodic table! What does that suggest to you?"
Socrates and Plato getting it on. More than I wanted to know about student-teacher relationships. And could I have just one subject that's not supposed to be the most important thing in the world? I should have taken plumbing. Actually, the stories and plays in the literature course all promised to be interesting. No surprise, since that has always been the most enjoyable part of school. It doesn't have any exams either, just essays, which suits me. I didn't want to major in lit, though. I couldn't see myself as a teacher, and I don't think anybody else gets paid to read the stuff for a living. I didn't have to choose a major for a couple of years. Maybe I could become the first Martian veterinarian. Wait for some animals to show up. Something I would never have predicted was that the virtual reality classrooms smelled more real than our real spaceship. If someone was chewing gum or eating peanuts near where you were sitting, it was really intense. Our air on board the John Carter was thin, and it circulated well. When you peeled the plastic off a meal, you could smell it for a few seconds, but then it was pretty much gone, and a lot of the flavor as well. Roberta and Yuri were also starting college, though in Yuri's case it was more like a practical conservatory. Most of his courses were music. I wondered how the time lag was going to affect that. When I suffered through my first piano lessons in grade school and middle school, I cringed in anticipation of the whack, whack, whack Miss Varleman would make with her stick on the side of the piano whenever I lagged behind. I might have liked learning piano if the teacher was 25 minutes away. My life settled into a fairly busy routine. Classes and homework and chores and exercise periods. A blood test said I was losing calcium, and so my 45-minute exercise requirement went up to 90 minutes, 2 hours if I could schedule it. Hard to beat the combination. What else is both tiring and boring for 2 hours? Actually, I could read or do limited VR while I was biking or rowing. It's kind of fun to row down the streets of New York or Paris. You do get run over a lot, but you get used to it. Routine or no routine, the possibility of disaster is always in the back of your mind. But you always think in terms of something dramatic, like an explosion on board or a huge meteoroid collision. When it did happen, nobody knew but the pilot. We had sprung a leak on the cube that would be air shrieking out, or at least whistling or hissing, which would be kind of nice because then you could find it and put a piece of duct tape over it. Ours was seeping out silently, and we didn't have too long to find the problem. Paul put a message up on every screen, a strobing red exclamation point followed by, "We are losing air!" that got almost everybody's attention. We were losing about a half of 1% a day. We were still 4 months away from Mars, so the oxygen would be getting pretty thin if we didn't fix it. It was easy enough to find the general area of the leak. Every part of the ship could be closed off in case of emergency, so Paul just had us close up each section of the ship, one at a time, for about 2 hours. That was long enough to tell whether the pressure was still dropping. First, we closed off Pod A, where I lived, and I was relieved to find it wasn't there. It wasn't in Pod B either, nor the solar storm radiation shelter. It wasn't the zero-G center room, which basically left the lander. That was bad news. As well as being the vehicle that would get us to the Martian surface, that was where all the pilot's instrumentation and controls were. We couldn't very well just close it off for the next 3 months and then refill it with air for the trip down. In fact, though, we wound up doing a version of that. First, Paul tried to find the leak with a punk. Not like Granddad's ancient music, but a stick of something that smoldered. The smoke should have led us to the leak. It didn't, though, which meant we didn't have a simple thing like a meteor. Micrometeoroid, technically. Hole. A seam or something was leaking. Maybe the port that the pilot looked through, or the airlock to the outside. Of course, there was also an inside airlock, between the lander and the rest of the ship, and that gave us the solution. Paul didn't have to live in the lander. He just checked things every now and then. In fact, he could monitor all the instruments with a laptop thing from anywhere. So although it made him nervous, not being able to run things from the pilot's chair, we closed off the lander and just let it leak. If Paul had to go in there every day or two, he could put on a spacesuit and go through the airlock. It made some of us nervous, too, like being cargo in a ship without a rudder. Okay, that was irrational. But we'd already had one emergency. What if the next one called for immediate action, but Paul had to suit up, waiting for the airlock to cycle through? That took about 2 minutes. In 2 minutes, we covered almost 1,000 miles. A lot could happen, and there weren't any spacesuits for the rest of us.